You're listening to Irish Radio Canada's Home and Abroad, and there's an event coming up at the end of the week, and it is the Dunmanway Homecoming. And the reason I'm focusing in on that, there's a few reasons. One is that I think it's the first one that has been organised, and there are some fascinating stories and history around Dunmanway in West Cork. It is associated with Sam Maguire, Duffy Circus. These would be things that people are very familiar with, but there's an awful lot of other things that are known and not known about Dunmanway. And Michelle O'Mahony is the coordinator, organizer, chief cook, bottle washer, driving force, everything else behind it. And Michelle is here. But Michelle, thanks a million. You're kicking off, this initial one's kicking off on Thursday evening.
Yeah, it is. So we have, so thank you for having me. I like the description. I'll answer to all of the above. Chief cook, bottle washer. We probably will be doing a little bit of bottle washing because it is kicking off on Thursday night with, wine tasting. So that's a meet and mingle and some wine or whiskey tasting, actually, for the people that are coming, to the event. It's a whole celebration of history, heritage, culture, largely driven by Dunmanway's global diaspora as a result of a Facebook group that started with 5 members maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And suddenly we have 5K members from all over the world. And it really is connecting people and driven by a want from the Facebook members to actually reconnect and come home to Dunmanway, meet cousins. Some of them don't even know who their cousins are, but they all figure they're all related one way or the other. So it's a welcome home for them, and they just want to walk the land of their ancestors. And we've now got a new whiskey called Ballabri 1615, so I'm sure they'll indulge in a little bit of that as well.
I couldn't help tongue-in-cheek kind of see that the whiskey tasting on the Thursday afternoon is sponsored by Costcutter. So does that mean it's half-cut?
It depends on where you look at it, but Costcutter, in fairness, they're one of the businesses in town that really, really pull out the sponsorship for all events that I organise. And the proprietor there is a character and a half. So he's actually come up with the Ballabri 1615 brand.
Right.
And that's just recently launched there only a week or so ago. And there's a 5-year-old malt, there is a 10-year-old, there's a regular, and as I was telling you earlier, there's this amazing honey liqueur, which really seems to be a combination of that traditional mead that medieval banquets used to have mixed with or blended with honey. And, you know, they even say it's good to even sprinkle on your porridge if you wanted to taste that good. So we'll find out next week when we taste them.
Now, I know with whiskies, it takes time for them to age. So I take it all the whiskies you're developing, it's a blend.
Well, what I've been told is that the whiskey has actually been put together with certain noses and whatnot and the different essences, and there's toffee flavours, honey flavours. A lot of them seem to be aged in ex-Kentucky bourbon barrels that have been brought back,
right,
is what the labels are suggesting and stating. But most of them are made specially to this person's brand,
yes,
in the St. Patrick's Brewery or Distillery up in Cork.
Right,
It's a new endeavour. Literally, the bottles are just landing on the shelves. I knew there was something in the offing. Didn't think it would be ready for the homecoming, but yes, it is.
Right, fantastic. So that you kick off on Thursday with the meet and the mingle. What kind of registration numbers have you got, Michelle?
So at the moment, we're looking at 100 people travelling from Canada, America, England, as far away as Australia and New Zealand. So that's 100 people coming back. And I would say, speaking to different people, you know, that have been making inquiries and various WhatsApp messages and chats over and back, I would say at least 90% of these people coming back have never been here before. Some of them, their ancestors left during the famine. Some of them left on convict ships. Some of them left around 1890 or early 1900s. But the one thing they all have in common is that they will probably be the first one of their family to return, which is quite unusual in this day and age. And some of them that are travelling long distances, they're already in Ireland and they're travelling around for the last 10 days before they'll hit Dunmanway.
Right, right. And I should say it's unusual for people not to have that they're generations and someone has come back. So it's also very special and it can be very emotional for that. So in order to cater to somebody like that, you know the questions they're going to ask. I know the questions they're going to ask. They want to see where the ancestors came from. They want to see where they're buried and all those kind of things. So the weekend encompasses a program that will respond to some of those requests.
Exactly. So I suppose when you have the Thursday afternoon with the meet and mingle, it's like about 2 hours of people getting to know each other, pick up their name badges, do the pleasantries, figure out if anybody with the same surname is related to them, or at least they'll think they are. Then we have the Minister for State, Christopher O'Sullivan, who's Minister for Heritage and Biodiversity and Nature. And by heritage, I'm talking built heritage and all that, as well as other heritage. So he is local to Clanachilty. He is coming to do the honours to officially open it. And we are also producing a homecoming journal as well, which he's going to launch. We can discuss that later and why that is important. And then we have a festival called Ballabui each August, bank holiday. So it's one of the oldest festivals in Ireland from 1615, hence the brand of the whiskey. We usually have a little bit of a fight over which is the oldest festival in Ireland, whether it's Ballabui or Cahirmi. There's always a few.
What about Bandoslaw?
I don't know. I think it's more Cahirmi seems to be the two that we always seem to Cahirmi or Ballabui. But look, there's only three in the running. You know, we can rotate which one we think is the oldest every now and again. Yeah. So then Mervyn O'Driscoll, who you had on your show there a few weeks back, he postgraduate days did a social history on the fear of Ballabui, and in 2018 he published that thesis and updated it a little bit, so we published that book. It's known as The Ascot of West Cork, and believe it or not, everybody thinks it's a fake title, but the newspaper headlines in the Cork Examiner in the 1890s and the early 1900s did refer to it as West Cork's answer to the Ascot of West Cork in terms of the fashion and people parading in their finery and loading up and coming on the early trains to West Cork. So he's going to take people gathered on a talk and a slideshow about Ballabui. And we also have traditional Irish butter making by the director of the Butter Museum in Cork, for Dr. Daniel O'Donovan. She's coming down and she's going to give a brilliant presentation and actually make butter from cream in front of people in your traditional churn.
Right. That's one thing I haven't got to yet, and I do want to get to, is the Butter Museum, because I know I've seen it, because Cork was the centre of the butter universe for a period of time.
Completely. Yeah. Like, I've been at one of Danielle's talks there in the last couple of months, and I was absolutely riveted, not only by, you know, seeing butter made the traditional way and having the buttermilk come off and how it's all put together, but then her presentation really brought it back, the significance and the importance of butter to the Cork city and county economy in the 1700s. It was just amazing to realise that up until about just before the time of the famine, 80% of all the global butter was produced in Cork. So that came from the city, it came from the butter markets, and obviously it was fed into the butter markets largely from the dairies around West Cork up through the butter pathways and the butter roads. And it was just phenomenal to actually see how cosmopolitan butter making was in Cork. You had all these, it's basically like having, if you think of the stock exchange, and you, instead of trading in stocks and shares, you're trading in butter and the quality of the butter, and there's fixed prices for certain sizes of it. But what really struck me was the Dutch input. I don't know if you've heard of that. Like, you've heard of the Firk and Crane Centre in Cork City, which is near the butter market. And as a historian, I had heard a little bit in the past, but she, you know, explained it really simple, that the firkin is a small barrel and the name firkin is Dutch. And a lot of the people that were adjudicating the quality of the butter were Dutch butter merchants who were involved in shipping it right around the world as well. So you have that cosmopolitan ethos going on in 1700s in Cork, where you have all these merchants from around the world congregating in Cork. And, you know, that's hard to understand today when we think we live in a cosmopolitan environment, when you realise it may actually have been a little bit more cosmopolitan back then through shipping and everything. So some things stay the same and some things change, but it was a real eye opener for people in the audience. So she's coming back delivering that same talk this time, which will be good.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, not to dwell too much on that, what fascinated me with that when I saw it as well was the ability to ship what is a product which has a shelf life around the world, and that it was able to do so when shipping was not as efficient as it is today.
Well, I think the answer to that is salt and very salty butter. So, you know, they used to actually test the, I suppose, the barrels as well to see how much salt was in each one. And, you know, the saltier the butter, the longer the shipping journey it could undertake. Right. But then that then goes back into, there was a huge salt trade as well for the preservation of beef and everything and curing meats. And there was a steady trade of salt coming over from Lisbon to Cork
right.
for the butter. And then anybody who wanted to export butter from Cork down to South America went via Lisbon. So the salt would come over on one ship and the butter would go back on another one to Lisbon. And from there, it would go down to the South Americas and into Brazil. So you have this phenomenal trade going on that she described it so eloquently with graphics and images that, you know, you really were kind of going, wow, there sure was some, you know, amount of shipping going on 200 and something years ago. And if, I think for people to see that now today visiting the homecoming, it'll sort of give them an idea of what their ancestors' lives were like.
The other thing something like that does, which is relevant to the ancestors, is that we forget that there were shipping lanes. And as a result of shipping lanes, there was emigration. And, you know, people often will talk in terms of the famine and the mass emigration or the Robinson migration. But there was shipping happening around the world, which explains why the Irish did have an influence in South America and all sorts of other places. And given that in Cork you had the butter exchange, and the, that if the milk and the butter was coming in from the hinterland, which included West Cork, I guess naturally you would have had people from West Cork working on the ships, getting and travelling the world.
Oh, of course, yeah. And like that's probably very relevant as well, I suppose, with the whole Irish America 250 episodes that I've done on podcasts. I think I mentioned this to you before about Stephen Moylan, the man from Cork who came up with the term the United States of America in a letter. And his background was in shipping. His father was a butcher. They lived around Blarney Street in the butter market and the cattle market area, that area of the north side of Cork City. And his father was heavily dependent on shipping and the salt trade because he was curing the meat. He had a butcher's department and an abattoirs and slaughterhouse. So salt was needed for their business, but they were also involved in shipping, which sees him go off to Lisbon on ships to get the salt and get the right grade of salt and go to the Mediterranean countries. He also was educated by the Jesuits in France during the penal laws, and he becomes a cosmopolitan person in his own right. So he ends up taking one of those ships then and goes to America and becomes the aide-de-camp to George Washington. And it's all because of this whole cosmopolitan shipping routes going on, by, for want of a better word, between salt and beef and butter. You know, it's strange how, you know, economy of that time led so many people to end up in America. And as I say to people, people forget that the Irish were going to places like Philadelphia in the late 1600s and the early 1700s. You know, migration is not something that happened around the famine years with coffin ships and any of that. It's been going on since ships could travel to America. People are going on them. And Irish people have been going on them. And we seem to have forgotten that in the bigger picture.
So that's the butter taken care of. And as you say, Mervyn's going to talk about Ballabwy. And that is a fascinating story, as you say, as well. It is also an annual event. So you've timed this homecoming that Ballabwy will be happening around the time.
Exactly. So we were very strategic. So there's the Ballabwy Festival Committee that organises Ballabwy every year and has the bands and the music and the races. And because it's a traditional fair, you have fair day on a Wednesday. But leading up to that, you have a number of flat racing and sulky racing and harness racing. All those racing events take place on Sunday and Monday. And then you have a traditional gathering on a Tuesday night into the Wednesday fair day. So that's one entity on its own. But we're starting our homecoming. We've coincided it with a few days before. So it's the Thursday and Friday and the Saturday. So people have a little bit of respite on Saturday evening before they go into the Ballabrie horse races on the Sunday. So it's a nice way to showcase the town and show people, I suppose, that are coming back for the first time, what traditions are still continuing in the town from the foundation of the town. So Ballabrie predates really a little bit of before the foundation of the town as a proper market town. But we're saying to them, look, you're coming back to the town of your ancestors, but this is a tradition that has been in existence for 400 years. It's as old as the town itself. So we're giving, I suppose, Ballabrie is being looked at now through a fresh set of eyes now by these global diaspora.
You mentioned there, and we were saying that, you know, an awful lot of people focus on the migration that happened around the time of the famine. And when it comes to West Cork, Skibbereen is very well known through history and song and a variety of others. But the famine wasn't just in Skibbereen, and workhouses and famine loss and graveyards were not just in one place. Dunmanway has its own workhouse, and the famine years had an impact there.
Oh yeah, so as you know, Austin, I write a lot on workhouses, and that's sort of my pet project throughout the years has always been the Irish famine. And I suppose down here in West Cork, sometimes there's almost this over, there's Epic Museum in Dublin, and that has a lot to do with the Irish famine, as well as Skibbereen and the Heritage Centre of the Famine Museum, and again up in Roscommon, up around Stokestown. But every town in Ireland was affected by the famine, and every large market town had a workhouse. And therefore, every workhouse had an accompanying graveyard a little bit situated outside the town that accompanied that at the time of the famine. And the question is, why are some more recognised than others? And what I find is, I find people coming through Dunmanway, and I meet with various tourists and say, oh, we're off to Skibbereen to see, I'm going out to Abbestoury and we're going to the famine graveyard. And I'm like, and did you have relatives there? No, our relatives are from Dunmanway, but we want to see the famine grave. And I'm like, well, you don't need to go. You need to get in your car. Follow me, and I will take you to a 6th century ecclesiastical site where a portion of that was used for the famine plot. And we've got an estimate of at least between, some people say 3, but recent evidence now by some archaeologists suggests we have 5 large pits that showcase and stagger the burials throughout the famine period, with the regular rectangular burials, as you would see, kind of speeding up a little bit by the time we get to Black 47. They can no longer, I suppose, put in individual graves. So they suddenly become pits. And as the famine gets worse, the pits get bigger. So I would say there's an estimate of between 300 and 500 bodies there in Dunmanway alone, which is a sacred site of its own. And it's largely underfunded, under-resourced. And recently there, I've managed with the local historic site, we put in some signage that traces the development of this ecclesiastical site. And you're looking at something that's probably a Bronze Age settlement that has transitioned over the years in various shapes and forms, and it was taken over and under the act of disestablishment of the churches. We've had Elizabeth I run through it. We've had changeover on churches from Roman Catholic to Church of Ireland. And we've even discovered recently that through the etymology of the various names of the site, they may even have been a leper colony there at some stage. And like, that's a huge history on its own, to bring somebody in and say, look, this is a 6th century site. And if you had relatives in Dunmanway going back to then, this is probably where they are, but we don't know where, but they're in there somewhere.
So you mentioned that most market towns would have had a workhouse. Dunmanway itself, insofar as the establishment as a market town or as a town, what was the stimulus, or why did Dunmanway?
How was it founded, and when did
why?
Oh, so I suppose if you, two things really. So the story goes that Sir Richard Cox, who was Lord Chancellor of Ireland, he was born in Bandon. His mother was from Clanachilty. He came out on the horse one day and was looking to find a nice area for a summer house. And he discovers you're familiar with Dunmanway Lake. He sees the lake, but he's actually looking at it from a height, because the main road into Dunmanway that we use today, just pretend that was all just forest and greenery and the lake was in the middle of it. He came in from the northern side on an approach at an elevated site, and he looked down and said, look, this is a lovely location for a summer house. But then he realised he had streams and rivers beside him, so that would be brilliant for water wheels, aka industry. And then he started thinking about linen. And then over time, the town started to take shape in his mind. It no longer was his summer residence from Bandon. It became a town of its own. So he starts looking at it from about 1670, And then by 1693, he applies for letters patent to officially name the town and designate it a market town. So the official designation of Domanway as a market town comes from 1693. So this year, if you're kind of thinking all things numerology, it's the 333rd anniversary of the founding of the town that this homecoming is coinciding with as well. So we're kind of striking a lot of anniversaries. And at that stage, then the town starts to develop. And he then puts in the streets and the houses start appearing. Weavers are brought in from Scotland in through Antrim and down into Domanway to actually set up the linen industry. And at that stage, you find then that there's a number of houses starting to pop up on the periphery, and then people gradually move into town and the streets and everything take shape. So by 1700, you have a fully flourishing market town, or you have a good stab at it and a good set of streets put in. Fanlubbis, then that old ecclesiastical site then diminishes, because that's like 2 miles away from this new town. So then Cox starts putting in the new churches, and the new Church of Ireland is built. And then in 1822, a subsequent one on the site of that earlier one gets built. And then by the late 1800s and post-famine years, you have the various religious orders then popping up, and then you see religion take shape. So the town then gradually takes shape, really, from the 1690s up to like the 200 years up to the late 1880s. That's when that whole infrastructure that we have today was put in place.
When you mention all that and bringing people in with various skills to establish industry, names are going to start appearing in the area. And that, I guess, is where the history starts coming in. You develop a genealogical whole history where people would say, well, some of the names that might be around Dunmanway would not be normal or usual Irish names.
Exactly.
So now you're going to see some of the descendants of these people as well. And you'd say, well, that's an unusual association with somewhere in West Cork.
Yeah. So like names like McCullough, McCull, Wallace, they all tend to have Scottish origins. And like some of those people now that have written in the journal, as I said, we're producing a journal as well, which is reminiscences of the diaspora. So people that we've invited, people that are part of this Facebook group, wherever they are, and whether they're coming or not, to submit articles about their family, where their family went to from Ireland, if they know where they are in Ireland, where they came from, or tell us what they did when they immigrated and went to Australia or wherever. And those stories have come true. And we have one which would be from, obviously the name is no longer Wallace, but it details the story of the Wallace family, who were brought in specifically by Richard Cox and headhunted from the linen industry in Scotland and brought to Dunmanway. But Dunmanway wasn't a developed town as such, so they lived in Kilmichael, a few miles outside the town. And they came in and out to help with the linen industry and get things off the ground. And again, that family then were able to tell us where they came from Scotland. Then you find that particular family then dovetailed into intermarrying with the McCulloughs. And then you have to figure out where they came from. And then when you start joining the dots, you realise that these are other weaver families. Then you see mixed marriages appearing. So you start seeing families with the same name that will be Roman Catholic. Then you see another branch that may be Methodist or Church of Ireland, Church of England. And you start to see that interaction and how names that would not be traditionally from, we'll say, the clans of McCarthy and O'Mahony and Crowley and Driscoll, how these other names have kind of crept into the equation over the years. And we're delighted that we are getting stories coming in and we're learning more, I suppose, to a certain extent about the missing link. We never really knew who the linen weavers were that were brought in first day, but we have one family now. And his story then, when he leaves Dunmanway after the time of the famine and goes down to Tasmania, and how they start still getting involved in textiles down there, they end up running drapery shops. So you have that whole continuity of what started with linen and weaving and textiles becomes a business down under. So there's that element of continuity and lots final pieces of the jigsaw starting to come together.
I mentioned up at the intro there famous families and famous people have come out of Dunmanway.
Too many to count.
The Sam Maguire connection with Dunmanway it's known but not that well known. Like everyone knows,
everybody knows about the trophy,
correct,
and nobody knows about the men. So I have a saying here that I don't mind who wins the trophy because the man we always has the man. So we have the homestead and he was born in Malibracca. We know that he recruited Michael Collins into the IRB. We know there was that connection there. We know his early life and he's buried in the Church of Ireland in Dunmanway. So that's always, it's always good to kind of tell, you watch GAA and your grandchildren play GAA, but even, if you're coming back from Australia or America and you're involved in any of the GAA clubs abroad, they'll be finding out, about the importance of Sam.
And I mentioned the circus. I know when I was growing up, when the circus came to town, you knew the circus was coming to town, but you didn't know where they were coming from.
Yeah, so Dunmanway is kind of steeped in history as regards circus history. And for anybody who is listening and has any connection to Dunmanway, just Google Duffy Circus. There's been a lot of activity in recent weeks. So Stories on the Street is a project that I spearheaded for Cork County Council, where we put up 12, I suppose, talking points via QR codes that link back into a podcast that anybody, whether you're listening abroad or here in town, can actually access on Spotify as well. But Plaque 5 deals with the history of the Duffy Circus and their connections to Dunmanway. Though the Duffy family, I suppose, didn't originate in Dunmanway. In the late 1920s, early 1930s, they chose to rent a large site in Dunmanway, and it became known as the Duffy's Circus Depot in Carberry, the area of town, Dunmanway, which is now Galvin's petrol filling station. And that site was where, from October until Easter, they wintered. So all the animals, the elephants, the Bengal tigers, the monkeys, and a lot of the families that travelled around with them stayed for the winter months. And they were like the regular family. They went to school. People have memories of going to school with the Duffy children, with the, I suppose, the trapeze artists' sons or daughters or whatever. And they gave huge employment to the town because you can imagine the supplies needed to feed elephants and tigers and keep them all happy on a winter's night. So we have all that documented now on the podcast. And Duffy's Circus was known as Ireland's National Circus. It was also known as Ireland's Mightiest Circus. So John Duffy and Sons, it was John Duffy Sr., who died in 1944, brought the circus to Dunmanway to winter. And then his sons, John and James, they continued it after his death from 1944 until about 1961. And then I don't know the full story, but there was a split through various grandchildren down the line. And then by the 1970s and the 1980s and 1990s, you have what's known as Tom Duffy Circus. There was other various variations in between and the 20 years in between. So that circus has always had its wintering grounds really in Dunmanway for those 30 years. And for many children growing up, it was the story of lore, local lore. People didn't believe it. So I did a bit of digging for the Stories on the Street project and interviewed a few elderly people with their stories and found out, that stories my father had told me was correct, such as the elephants taking a walk to the lake to be washed or drink water, monkeys escaping in the middle of the night and a few locals out looking for them and hopefully finding them because, otherwise there's a few monkeys on the loose somewhere still in the woods around Dunmanway. Bengal tigers howling mad when we had a bad stormy night with a gale force wind. So all of these stories nobody really believed, and I went into some of the schools in Dunmanway, told them the stories so that we had children then willing to volunteer to do voiceovers. And recently there was a famous clown in Tom Duffy and Sons passed away, and his collection of memorabilia, which consists of approximately 600 miniature figurines, went to auction. And that has found its way back to Dunmanway now through a donor who bought it. And that we're hoping will be on display from time to time. And if you look up Dunmanway's 600 strong memorabilia collection of clowns, you will find links recently to Stories on the Street. And there are some videos of the figurines, shall I say. And I for people that love circuses, the connection with Duffy's will always be there. I'm not a huge fan of circus myself, but I'm in the middle of the road, and then I know other people who are absolutely terrified and they're phobic of clowns and they would not come near them to see them. and more people then just cannot get enough of them. They think it's really, really cool. So it's a lovely link. You know, we've got everything in demand way from Sam Maguire and the GAA to a little bit of fun and memorabilia and clowns.
Indeed. So, Michelle, I know the events are going to be happening at the weekend. If somebody didn't take the time to register, there's enough empty seats that you can accommodate a few extra people.
Well, I'm sure we can accommodate a few extra people if they're on a flight. And as I say, you have my details and they can just contact me by email. Or if they're listening to this or they have family in Ireland that are coming down to it, just let us know.
And you mentioned the Facebook page. Would the Facebook page be probably the best place to try to connect and reach out?
Well, if you're connected anyway to Dunmanway, I would say reach out through this Facebook group called the Descendants of Dunmanway and West Cork, or the local Dunmanway Historical and Cultural Association. They'd be your two main Facebook groups. But the Descendants page has over 5,000 members at this stage, and they're from all over the world. And what's happened now in the last 2 or 3 years, I've noticed, is a lot of the locals who would have an interest in genealogy are coming on stream when somebody posts a black and white photo saying, this was my great great grandfather, he lived in such a townland. You will find locals coming on board suggesting they may know, they may not, but you will start getting leads. And it's a great way to spread news, you know, and reconnect people and join the dots for them and help them out. So it's a good Facebook group, you know, and it's really, really taken off.
Michelle, we're going to have to wrap up. It's been fascinating
okay.
and brilliant chatting with you, and thank you so much for taking the time. I wish I could be there. Can't.
So do I.
But who knows?
Because if you were there, Austin, I'd ask you to do MC and I'd take a back seat for once.
Yeah, I don't have the accent. Go to Michelle.
Clangafold.